Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome, everybody, to Paranexus Universe. This is Doug Kelly, your host. Today is Thursday, June 11th, 2009. I'm here with my good friend and co-host, Grant Rubendunst. Hey, Grant.
Hey, Doug. How's it going this evening?
Hey, everything is fine. We've got Brian Parsons with us tonight.
Excellent.
We're going to be bringing Brian on here in just a moment. We want to welcome all of our listeners. Thanks so much for joining us this evening. We're going to talk about some tips and techniques for investigations. And Brian's got some good stuff to share. We're going to talk about his experiences and what he's learned and so on and so forth. So we appreciate everybody coming in. And if you've got questions, feel free to type them in the chat room, or if you'd like to call in, you're more than welcome to. The number is there on your screen. Or if you have a headset, you can use that click-to-talk button on your page as well and get a hold of us. We welcome your calls if you want to call in. So without any further ado, tonight we have Brian Parsons. He's the director of the Ohio Paranormal Investigation Network. He is also a regional director for Ohio for the Paranexus CPFI program. Brian, welcome to Paranexus Universe.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to have you. We're excited to have you part of Paranexus and regional director out there in Ohio. So you've been doing this a while, haven't you?
You could say a few years. Since 1996, I kind of got my feet wet. And funny as it is, before that, I was a complete non-believer. I had been raised, parents taught me, hey, ghosts don't exist, which was fun because it helped me get some sleep at night. But a few years later, I kind of got into some questions, you know, in adolescence, and people were talking about urban legends and folklore, and got into a pretty heated discussion at work about one, actually a local one. And it was funny because I wanted to ask other people if they'd heard of that, and some older people had actually heard of it, and they told me what they thought, and I thought, well, this is kind of silly, but it's funny, everyone believes the same thing. So I went out and I learned how to really investigate these urban legends and looked up a lot of information from various sites, libraries, and actually the site itself, and educated myself on that. And that's when I stumbled into parapsychology, which I'd heard about it before. In college, I took some psychology courses, and of course they downplayed the legitimacy of parapsychology heavily, saying it was a junk science and pretty much
right.
Throwing it under the bus. But
can you speak up just a little bit, Brian, if you
okay, sure, think. Sure. But really learning about parapsychology, reading what they had written about the ASPR, the beginnings of it, and what all the research they've done, and it was kind of funny because some of the people that were involved in that were also involved in the psychology that I learned from. So I thought that was kind of strange that maybe I was being hidden some truth there. So I learned a lot about parapsychology, and some of my friends were interested in that as well, and one thing led to another. And next thing I know, our little social group we had, people were pointing at me as the leader of our organization, which was kind of a shock to me because I had no idea that I was actually in charge. It's been a roller coaster ride. It's been uphill and downhill, and I've had to rebuild a few times. But it's been great, and I've wanted to walk away a few times, but the clients who need help really always bring me back. And I feel like I'm not an expert, but I've learned so much that I really I don't want to walk away. I want to share as much as I can. I want to teach people as much as I can, and I want to help clients as much as I can learn about what's going on. And lately, obviously, everyone knows that there's, I don't know if anyone's seen it, but there's some shows on television that kind of glamorize what we do. And
there is?
Kind of, yeah.
I'm sorry, you're wrong. Say it ain't so.
I forget. I forget what it's called, but I call it the almighty popular paranormal, or the almighty paranormal show, I guess you could say.
Yeah, right.
It stands for something if you spell it out at home. But I think there's a lot of misconceptions that are being passed down, and that's a little bit of what I want to talk about tonight, is some of the things that people are learning from watching television and kind of taking out into the field that maybe they shouldn't be. They should maybe leave that in the make-believe.
Well, you know, the interesting thing is, Brian, is that on these shows, I think what people really don't realize about getting involved in this research is those shows are condensed, and they may be, you know, occur over a period of time, or they're just completely embellished for the sake of drama for TV. But they don't see it that way. I think that many people are on this misconception that ghosts are flying around all over the place at houses. And, that's a sad state because they're just, especially if they want to go into investigation. Because as you and I and Doug well know, it can be hours of boredom in the sense that nothing occurs.
Definitely. And, you know, sometimes I've seen them do that where they do time lapse on there and show them sitting around, which is great. And I don't want to take anything away from that group. I've read their book that they wrote, and I think it's really, really good. And even if you don't like the show, I'm not a big fan myself, but you kind of have to watch it so you know what's going on. But their book is fantastic, and I really praise them for what they've written in their book, because it's their approach in the book is really not portrayed in the show, and it's a shame. And that really obviously is a testament to the fact that it's about entertainment. It's about bringing viewers onto television and showing them what it's all about, which is not reality in that aspect, even though it's reality television. But
well, you know, it probably gets frustrating for them because there's a lot of things about their work that both Doug and I admire, and, you know, it's a shame because, you know, I can just see, I just get this picture in my mind of a TV producer going like, all right, come on now, guys, when's a ghost going to appear? Or let's show a little excitement, you know, and that just ruins the whole thing.
So, yeah, Brian, go ahead. Yeah, go ahead and ask after you're done.
I was just going to say it's really unfortunate that they really can't do what they want to do because you can kind of feel it. You kind of sense that the things really aren't going in the direction that you would think that they would really want to go in.
I remember one episode, and I don't watch it anymore. I haven't for, man, probably a year. But there's one episode where this guy had things rigged in his house, you know, the face behind a mirror and things like that. He had it rigged. And, I mean, that whole investigation was lost because they discovered it pretty quickly, pretty early on, and they remained there, and I'm sure it was the producer. Yeah, we're going to have to stay here, and, you know, we can't just walk away from it. It's too bad because I would have, you know, look, dude, I don't know who you're trying to fool here, but, you know, we're out of here. We don't do this. So, interesting stuff. So, well, let's talk about some of the different things that you've picked up over the years and learned about. And, you know, feel free to jump in. What's one of the more important things that you've learned over the years of investigating that makes it more effective, that's helped you out, that you would recommend to others?
Well, one thing that I think is important, and it's not really to help you investigate, but it's really important to help you keep you in the field, is confidentiality. And I think it's a huge thing right now because, again, to talk about, I don't want to use this television show throughout this whole thing, but it kind of ties into some of this stuff. People see how it's done there, and they want to translate that into their own group. And unfortunately, a lot of groups are posting case information that borders on client information on their websites, and it's become a huge trend. And I'm not afraid to speak out that I think it's pretty wrong. Even though, yes, you're sharing your information, yes, you're sharing your data, which is great. I applaud that. But Where do you draw the line? Where do you say enough's enough? That's too much information.
What are they posting that's compromising the confidentiality?
Well, a lot of it, you know, if you show that even in the inside of someone's home, you know, they have friends, they have family, people know, and it's just a matter of time. And even if you say a city, being in Ohio, I know I've been to cities that you have maybe 500 people that live in that city. You know, Ohio's has a lot of small towns like that, and there's small towns all across the United States. So, like I said, though, where do you draw the line? What information do you include and not include? You know, changing the names to protect the innocent can only go so far, but when you're talking about case information and showing the client's interior of their house, how far do you really go? And it's become a huge trend lately, and YouTube is just filled with them. I have a couple of groups that I'm friends with that do that, so I'm not completely against it. They try as hard as they can to keep it on the straight and narrow, but unfortunately, there's a lot of people out there that don't.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of takes away from the people who are trying to do things right, trying to show, hey, this is what I'm doing, this is what we did here. Try to replicate it. Try to do. I mean, that's part of the scientific method, but it kind of compromises what the clients think about our field. You know,
well, I think it just shows the level that they're operating at, that they really don't understand any type of client relationship, you know, and what's involved in it. Because as you fellows well know, you know, anything that's shared with you should be kept strictly confidential, unless you get, you know, information from the client or release from them. And you know, if folks are doing that and they're, you know, I could see it happening, because the road to hell is paved with good intentions. They may think that they're giving a lot of pertinent information when in reality they may be doing somebody a lot of harm, particularly if there's sensitive issues there.
So what you're saying, Brian, is to groups should really use discretion on what they post and what they include in terms of pictures, and make sure that the pictures don't include sensitive information or personally identifiable features. If you're going to post the pictures, don't post the town, things of that nature.
Right. I mean, I'm not completely against it, although, like I said, there's a couple of groups that I'm pretty close with, and they do this, and I've told them how I felt, but they really do go through a lot to make sure that they're not showing anything. They're really responsible about it, because they are, you know, making headway in this field and doing things that they should be doing. So I applaud that. But at the same time, there's a lot of people on there that are creating things or fabricating things or really lying about what they're doing, or, you know, coming up with fake videos, which a lot of people can spot. It's not that hard. But a lot of people will fall for these things. And if a group posts something on their site that actually happened in a real investigation that they're really excited about, there's going to be a good portion of the people that are just not going to buy it. So is it really helping the field, or is it helping the bragging rights of the people involved?
Well,
ultimately, is it helping the client?
Bragging rights are a big issue, which is directly tied to ego, and a lot of the ghost hunting groups do have a lot of stuff on there, and a lot of it is misidentified. You know, they'll put things up that just really don't hold a lot of weight, and you know, and I'm going to say it again for the umpteenth time. Frankly, pictures and video as a whole don't mean much. It's almost worthless. So, you know, somebody says, I've got this really cool picture. Yeah, you know, there might be one, you know, one in a large number that is compelling. But for the most part, pictures and video in this day and age are just worthless as evidence.
Yeah, and it's unfortunate. But it's really, if you look at the history of ghost investigation, which, by the way, I'm not sure if people know this, it goes beyond 5 years. A lot of groups don't realize that parapsychology has been around for 125 years.
Right.
They've been doing this, you know, since that time. And a lot of what we know now came from 100 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the, when the age of spiritualism occurred in the mid-1800s, part of the fraudulent aspect was spirit photography. And I think we're seeing a resurgence in that with orb photos, which when digital cameras came out, there was some obvious problems with pixelization and things like that. We've moved past that. Now people are swept up in all the other little things that happen with cameras, and it's evidence at most, scant evidence at best. And like you said, it's not, you cannot get proof from that. And I think a lot of people think, hey, we're going to get this this photo, or we're going to get this orb on video, and we're going to be famous. We're going to be going on tour and showing everyone our video, and look at us, you know, having people write our autobiography. It's
make a movie.
It's not practical. It's not logical.
Mm-hmm. So you had mentioned to me something about when you're investigating, should it be dark or not? That kind of a thing. You want to expand on that?
And that's another controversial topic. A lot of people get really defensive about that. And there, if you really break it down, there's really two reasons why people do it. First and foremost, I think, is because it's popular. It's what they do on TV, so it must be real, right? It must be the way to go. And the other one is makes a little bit more sense to me. It's because of the technology. We have infrared cameras, and it offers us a glimpse into the infrared spectrum, which many theorize will help us see ghosts, which I don't know if you really believe heavily in parapsychology. That's really not an option when you're dealing with optics, when you're dealing with cameras and video. It's more of a human interaction aspect, but, you know, to humor that, has anyone really done any work with that in finding any information with the infrared spectrum? I really haven't read anything about it, certainly not in ASPR journals, the SPR journals, parapsychology journals. I haven't read anything about IR. So whether or not that's based in reality or it's just based in popularity, who's to say?
Well, yeah, it's one of those things, you know, that honestly, I mean, you think about it. With all the DVR systems out there, with all the, you know, the shows that use them, you know, what have they come up with? I mean, if you go through all that time with footage, and this has been my issue with DVR systems for probably the last 2 years anyway, is that you spend all this time and money setting up this camera stuff, and you go through all the footage only to find nothing, and even if you did capture some kind of a legitimate, genuine apparition, what do you end up with? You're left with a cool video that doesn't really tell us a whole lot about what's going on.
Right.
And so that's my problem with all that. Now, there are times to use DVR systems. I mean, you just have to use your own good judgment. But, you know, it's like, do you need to investigate in the dark? Does it have to be dark?
Right. It depends on the circumstances. It depends on the case. I mean, if you have a client that they always see something in the dark, well, hey, that's great. Turn off the lights and have at it. But if a client is having things happen in normal lighting conditions with their lights on, then why investigate in the dark? It just doesn't make sense from a point of view of trying to simulate what the client is having happen to them.
Yeah, you know, and I sincerely hope that our audience, people that are interested, are hearing what the larger message that you guys are sending them, and that's like, you really got to think out of the box.
Think for yourself.
Absolutely, but think out of the box. I mean, don't just go out there and duplicate what you think is research because you've seen it on TV. Do a little research before you even go out. Hopefully these groups are doing it. But, you know, the larger picture is don't think in a traditional manner. Be willing to think outside that box.
Oh, definitely. You can't mock what you see on television. I mean, even reading books. You know, I suggest to all my new members that I get, or anybody that asks me questions, that don't follow one belief system. Read as many books as you can on different approaches, because no one's right. No one has the answer. So, and no one's an expert. You cannot be an expert in the unknown. It's impossible. So learn as many approaches as you can and try things until you get something to work, then that's awesome. Then pass that information on to someone else so they can replicate that or find flaws in it. And that's science. That's how it works.
Do you feel, Brian, that your group, since the early days of you guys going out and doing investigations, how would you say your group has evolved over the years?
Well, unfortunately, I'm the only surviving member of the original group, but obviously my knowledge and experience has helped new people who have come across into the group, and I think we've really expanded our knowledge and expanded the people that we knew. Granted, there's a lot more people around now than there was 13 years ago. You pretty much knew everybody.
How about philosophically, in your approach, how would you say that you've evolved in terms of how you conduct an investigation when you first started as opposed to how you would approach it now?
Well, philosophically, like I said, before I started out, I didn't believe in any of this stuff. And I think when I first jumped into this, I opened my mind too wide, and I think my brain fell out. I believed in everything, and I jumped on every case and went with the client, and yes, this is great. You know, I can't wait. You know, we're going to help you through this or whatever. And I didn't have enough skepticism in me to really balance myself out. And after a while, the technology really wasn't a big deal back then, and it became a bigger deal as it became more affordable. And I think there became a point that I became obsessed with the tools and the technology, and I lost focus with the client. I kind of got too involved with the science aspect and trying to find answers by the tools. So I had to find a balance to science and the people and the client. And I think it's taken me quite a while to do that, and I think that's where I am right now, where I can balance things evenly. And, you know, maybe I've seen and met other people that have done that quicker than I have. And that's part of the thing I'm trying to teach people, is that don't fall in love with one aspect or the other. You know, you may have a group leader who's totally into science, and that's what they're all about, but they should surround themselves with other people that can help balance that so you have a well-rounded group. And it'll teach you a lot about what you're doing and your approach, because you have to have balance. It's very, very important.
Well, I appreciate you bringing that up, because that is so true. You know, paranormal investigation is more about the people aspect, while researching things scientifically, if you want to put it that way. But it's so much about the human condition. It's all about the human condition. It's about the human element. And, you know, to go do an effective investigation, you know, most of the time you don't need much equipment. I mean, you go in there with an audio recorder and good people skills, which are so lacking across society in general,
right?
You can get so much information. If you've got good interviewing skills, if you go there and you find out that really we've got a case of, it's more human psychology than it is paranormal, and you're able to coach the client effectively, you know, that's what it's about. You know, that's also part of the helping thing. And then occasionally we get those cases which are compelling, and we don't quickly resolve, so, you know, we might get out some pieces of equipment to do more research. Good point.
And I think a lot of people they just fall in love with trying to prove that ghosts exist instead of trying to work with that client to figure out their experience, whether or not it is logical, there's a logical explanation, or, you know, what their perceptions were about what happened. And just like you said, I think the interviewing aspect is the most important, because that's where you're really going to find your, maybe not all your answers, but you're certainly going to find your direction and where you need to go with the case.
And you have a great, I just want to tell the audience this, you know, you have a great, great article on interviewing skills on your site, too. And I posted the site in the chat room. It's ghosthelp.net. So take a look at Brian's site.
I would agree entirely with that, Doug, you know, and Brian. The interviewing process is absolutely crucial to any investigation. And I can recall several investigations that we've conducted, Doug, where, you know, initially everything, you know, was kind of rolling along. And then because we kind of prolonged that process, we felt that there was something more going on. We got all kinds of information that led us to some conclusions about what was going on in the case fairly rapidly, and they were more psychological as opposed to anything else going on there. So had we gone in, and maybe this is a mistake that some newer groups might make, is go in, interview very quickly, or just do a very brief contact with the client, and then just go looking for ghosts. And you may be looking for a long time and not find anything.
Right. And again, that's where they get their training from. You can tell how a group approaches their investigations by where they got their training from. And that's, you've just described, again, the television show, the Almighty Paranormal Show. And it's unfortunate that, and I think the other aspect is continuing education. That's something that I have done. That's why I'm still around. And that's why I'm on this show tonight, because I've continued my education. I didn't stay stagnant and felt like I knew everything there is to know about this field.
That's absolutely critical. You always have to be growing, you know, because, you know, growth is optional. You know, I mean, change is inevitable, but growth is optional. And, you know, the people that refuse to change or to kind of tweak whatever their parameters are not going to be successful in this, and they're going to, you know, they may be successful in the sense that they'll see ghosts everywhere and they'll be happy, but their research will be absolutely worthless and meaningless.
You know, I've got something to add on that, too. Something I was working on today. I'm working on the UFO course and doing research for it, of course, and rereading some of the old books I've had for years. And you know, something that I've been kicking around for a long time is that there just hasn't been a lot of progress made in the anomalous research field, and I include all of it in that statement. I'm talking about UFOs, abductions, you know, hauntings, parapsychology, all of the stuff. There's been precious few breakthroughs in the last few decades on this, and so it's like, what do we do now? I mean, where do we go from here? It's like so many people have collected so much evidence that really is not satisfactory. I mean, it doesn't really tell us a whole lot about the nature of things. So what do we do next? You know, where do we take it from here? I mean, I've heard some people say, some investigators say, well, you know, this is it. Until you know, we make contact with aliens, they land and we talk to them, you know, what else can we do with it? And, you know, I can empathize with those sentiments. However, we're at the point where we need to reinvent the field. Okay, where do we go from here? We've already gone one direction. We've collected what evidence we can collect. Now what do we do with it? What other options are there? Because one of the things that I'm more sure of than ever, and I become more sure every day, is that there are commonalities among hauntings, parapsychology, ufology, and abductions. They're, in essence, all the same thing, only different. And there are connections. There are definite connections. And so what's going on here? And I might even, if I wanted to stretch a little bit, say, you know, we could even push that into cryptozoology just a smidgen with some of these Bigfoot sightings and other sightings of these mysterious animals that almost have a paranormal nature to them. So what's really going on? We need to rethink the field. We need to rethink our direction. We need to reinvent it, if you will, based on the knowledge and data we've collected to date.
Absolutely. And, you know, the thing of it is that it may be something that's uniquely human and a total new way of how humans perceive everything around them based on our situation and the dimension we're in and the space we're in. And how one person's reality is totally different from the next. And it's going to be something that as time goes on, we may find that it's projection or it's something that we have innately within us by virtue of being human.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think, Doug, you hit the nail on the head when you're talking about UFOs. It's really out of our hands. It's really until the other aspect of that, which would be the extraterrestrial intelligence, decides, hey, these guys are worthy of our communication. I don't think it's going to be up to us to find that evidence. I think that evidence is going to present itself when it's time.
Mm-hmm. The genuine.
Talking about ghosts and paranormal investigation, I mean, you look back to when psychical research began 125 years ago. It began out of the skepticism of what was going on. People were being swindled and lied to about things that were going on, and they wanted to get to the bottom of it. And these were scholars. These were educated people. And, you know, granted, 60, 70 years later, the funding dried up. There were no answers. There was no really good approach to what they were doing. There was no testable laboratory things you can really do, and they lost their funding for it. But now I think we're really at a rebirth with that, with the amateur movement, which, again, began longer than 5 years ago. It's just been going on for a good 20, 30 years. I mean, there were people around before I got here. So I think we're still in our infancy with that, and it's interesting to see that we do have a different direction when you're talking about the amateurs. With parapsychologists, they were more focused on the human.
Mm-hmm.
And they were looking at the client and their experience and what was going on in their brain.
Mm-hmm.
And now with the amateur movement, we're looking at the ghost itself, and we're kind of looking back toward the client. So that is a little bit of a change of perspective for the field that we're in now. So, and it's again, it's not going to happen overnight. It didn't happen overnight for parapsychologists, even though they've brought everything that we know now to us, and it took them quite a while to do so. So I think with our amateur movement, and we're seeing a lot of progress. If you look 5, 10 years ago, how disorganized everything was, we are moving in a good direction, slowly but surely, about spreading education, about getting people together, about forming camps of thought, which is very important when you're talking about fields of science, getting people on one bus. Not everybody thinking the same way, but getting different groups of people going in different directions to find the answers. And whether or not we come up with those answers, it's going to be hard to say. But I think we're in an advantage with so many people on the path, so many people doing different things, that it could only be a matter of time till we start finding answers. But I think
the biggest thing we have over the Victorians, Brian, is the fact that we have technology. And
right.
I think that although, you know, I don't place all my faith in the technology, I think that, you know, we may have come up, you know, we need to look at different frequencies and how they interact, and take a closer look at quantum physics. And we may be able at some point down the line to actually, you know, test things or have a way to measure it that they never did. Granted, you and I both know, and Doug as well, that sometimes if there is paranormal activity, and it's legitimate, it's very fleeting, so it's difficult to capture that. But maybe there may be some form of technology that we're not yet aware of that may allow us or enable us to catch snippets of that. And that will be the best foundation. Whether
right.
it's human-generated or whether it's external to humans, that's what's going to be the most interesting part.
Right. I think that's going to have to go hand-in-hand with true scientists. I think until we really discover what consciousness is, I mean, right now we can't even prove consciousness exists. So how do we say that ghosts can create consciousness or we carry on a consciousness? We have to start at the ground level. So I think we're going to have to meet with what's being done in the scientific field by professionals. And I think the amateurs will bring something to the table ultimately as well to kind of bridge the gap. I mean, you're looking at things, it's going to have to happen from two ends of the spectrum. We're going to get a theory and we're all going to have to pounce on that theory and try to drive forward to through a hypothesis and find some answers on our end of the bargain too. And it's going to be a collaborative effort. That's the only way I see it ever happening, to bring any pieces of the puzzle together to form a picture. And it's going
well,
to
you know,
time.
The nice thing about it is let's assume, just for the sake of hypothetical argument, that the day after tomorrow a scientist invents some sort of a optical device that actually sees some form of cogent energy, but it has from whatever data he collects, you can see that it has certain characteristics. Well, with all the people that have been out in the field, and those of us that have been smart enough to hang on to our data, what if the scientific community said, "We got a call. Do you have any data that looks similar to this? Submit it to us." So we may make our contribution to pure science, you know, unknowingly.
Right.
I mean, that's a
hypothetical
situation, but a lot of times, you know, look at astronomy. Some of the people that find interesting things in astronomy are backyard astronomers. I mean, it's not the rule, it's the exception, but it does happen.
Right. Again, it's going to take a collaborative effort, but you're absolutely right. Those of us who really take these as case studies, which is exactly what we're doing. Again, you can't repeat these in a laboratory setting. You can't conjure up a ghost. You can't. They happen when you least expect it. You can't really set anything up for it. So what we're doing is collecting case studies, which is a form of science, and eventually that data will add up to something.
Here's a good concept brought up in the chat room about the percentage of group of investigations that come from actual clients. And Global Paranormal makes the comment, the number is relatively small in comparison to the amount of groups that are out there. And I think that's an interesting point. You know, I've always wondered about that too, that, I mean, there seems to be a whole lot of groups and relatively few cases from clients. Have you found that, Brian?
I've seen my caseload dwindle over the years, and I completely attribute it to the fact that right now, currently, there's at least 123 currently active groups that take client-centered cases, and I've spent a lot of time researching that number, and it's amazing that there's that many groups, and I'm still receiving. It's kind of hard to judge because, you know, you guys probably know, it hits in waves. You'll get a bunch, and then you'll kind of be slow for a while. It's like that with everybody. But I look at how many I get, you know, and I know if I'm getting this many, how many is everyone else getting? And then how many are universities getting? And then how many are unreported? Mm-hmm. It's got to be mind-boggling how many cases are actually out there.
How many legitimate cases may be out there that aren't being reported? Those are the people that we want to hear from, but we never do, unfortunately.
Yeah.
Or rarely.
The high strangeness cases, I mean, those are the ones I want big time, and not just hauntings. I want all of them, you know, anything anomalous, whether it's
But you know the problem with that, Doug, is people get so spooked by those high strangeness cases because they get ridiculed, you know?
Yeah, they do, but
they get ridiculed fairly quickly.
Only if that information becomes freely available, and that goes right back to what Brian brought up earlier about confidentiality, and of course, with us, that's a huge, huge deal. I mean, you break that trust, and it's over with. You know, your reputation's gone. So, you know, I want those big cases, those high strangeness cases, because that's where it's at. I mean, you know, Grant, you and I have talked about this before. I mean, all these cases that we've done, they were great, especially in the beginning years. But then, you know, you quickly realize that this is really not getting us anywhere. Yes, it's helping people, and we still do it for that. But it's not really helping the research. What I'm looking for is the compelling ones, and there's a few out there, you know, that you just can't readily explain. And so, you know, I wish people would come forth. I mean, abductions, UFO sightings, especially abductions, and really strange parapsychological cases, you know, things floating around, moving, things of that nature, because then perhaps we can start to draw some comparisons and do some things. One of the things that I think are fascinating from a variety of aspects is channeling, and I posted something in the Paranexus forum on that. I find it fascinating, this just channeling. It's something that, and I find it fascinating from a psychological point of view. It's not that I automatically believe. In fact, most of them I don't believe. I mean, we remember Blossom Goodchild, bless her soul. And it's so funny. I'll be doing more writing on that. But you can take all of these channeled messages and take a paragraph from each different one and put them all together, and you can't tell any difference. You know, they're ambiguous. They're evasive. They're manipulative, they sidestep the issues, and they don't have any substance to them. It's fascinating, and yet so many people want to believe, but I don't want to get off on that. So, Brian, what's one of the more compelling cases you've just researched over the years?
Well, honestly, one of the most intriguing, in my opinion, is I worked with a person who, she was in an apartment building, and it was actually a converted hotel. And don't really want to give the location away, but it's obviously in Ohio. But she, was having some of the basic things happen, saw some shadows, heard some breathing and some walking in her apartment, and it progressed. It got worse, which excited me because it's increasing in intensity and frequency. That's the best time for me to get involved.
Mm-hmm.
So she invited me out. She didn't want to meet at her place, so we met at a neutral location and talked about everything that was going on, and it seemed like a textbook, even though there's no such thing as textbook, you know, just an intelligent apparition, intelligent haunting, and started really getting involved in the interviewing process, and all of a sudden she put the brakes on and said that she couldn't do this, and she didn't want to be involved anymore, and I thought that was strange, so I kind of did some digging. I went back to the apartment building and started asking some people, and I noticed they got really defensive about it, and they got really upset that I was asking questions. And I thought that this was really strange, so I finally convinced her to tell me what happened. And basically, what happened was this ghost was very, very popular with all the residents in this converted hotel. And they were very defensive. They didn't want anybody coming and investigating because they were afraid they were going to lose their friend.
Mm.
And I thought, wow, this is excellent. These people actually communicate with this ghost. They see it all the time, and they almost have conversations with it. And I tried as hard as I could to get in there, try to be, display that I didn't want to chase it away. I wanted to learn. I mean, that's what I'm here for, is to learn. And I explained about the client that contacted me, and she was afraid, and I was trying to help her through that situation. And ultimately, unfortunately, I was not able to get in there to investigate any further. But I talked to several people who lived there and had lived there, and I was just amazed at the culture that was created by this ghost that they kind of nicknamed Casper the Friendly Ghost, which is, I guess, is pretty obvious. But it was really interesting, the social aspect that was created by this ghost. These people were not afraid, and they actually came to protect it because it was their friend, and they perceived it that way, that all these different people had seen the same thing and had different experiences with it and were not afraid at all. As a matter of fact, they were very defensive of it. And to me, that could have been the greatest case I ever investigated, but I kind of got shut up.
Yeah, that is an intriguing, because most of the time it's just the opposite. People are upset and fearful. And so that's very intriguing. So is the building still standing? Is it still an apartment house?
It's still there. It's further in disrepair than ever. And, it's not doing so well, but it's still there. Everyone that I had talked to before is gone, and I keep hoping that somebody will contact me from there, but
mm-hmm.
That was quite a while ago. It was about 10 years ago now.
Yeah.
So what other things have you learned in your tenure here that would be of value to other investigators? I mean, what do you feel strongly about? What's some of your, the things that you really do as a routine?
Well, as a routine, and something that I think that people really need to realize is the tool aspect. Again, to talk about tools, the EMF detector, people probably won't believe this, but parapsychologists used EMF detectors, which, by the way, when they first started using them, they had to wheel in on large carts. I mean, they were huge. They weren't like our handheld thing that you lose in your pocket sometimes. These were huge. They had to bring them in on the video carts that you see in schools and libraries. They were huge. But they used them to look for logical explanations. They look for EMF. They look for logical things that are happening. And I don't know where it happened that we felt that these were ghost detecting tools, but somewhere along the line that something got lost in the translation, and people really are using the tools for the wrong aspect. And I can admit that when I first started out, I really didn't realize that, and I was using, trying to walk around like Ghostbusters, walking around trying to sense something, and it's really not what they're designed for. There's no such thing as a ghost detector. These are made to either find man-made EMF or the natural EMF, AC and DC. And if you use them for that, you're going to find a lot of answers. That's basically what we use them for. We actually use them more for logical explanations to rule out certain things that are happening, such as, alarm clocks that are too close to you at night. If you're having a lot of bad dreams or nightmares or seeing things at night, that's the first thing we check for. We suggest to move that, and then we see how things progress. if things get better, then great. And we help the client. You know, we didn't get any knowledge or information from that case except for what's worked in the past. You know, and you do that throughout the home, throughout the areas that they're experiencing things, and you continue to use the tools to find logical explanations first. If you use them to jump to the other conclusion, you can find ghosts all night if you really want to.
Yeah.
They're really there. You know, you're there to help the client validate what they saw, or really in reality find the logical reasons for them to really help validate what they saw. You know.
Well, it's always interesting when you see somebody with an EMF meter in their hand and it's going off and they're like all excited thinking that, oh my God, the ghost is right here right in front of me right now. And they're probably standing in front of a circuit box or something. You know, and a lot of times, and you're absolutely correct on this because you do see this a lot. And I think people are very misled into believing that that is a ghost detector, and when it goes up, there's a ghost standing right next to you, or you're catching him by his sheet or whatever.
Right. And it's part of the process because, like you stated earlier, it's people think that they show up to the house, they get a little information, they set up their equipment, and they go to town, and then they pack up and, you know, they come back for the reveal a couple of days later. Well, in reality, to really investigate a case thoroughly, you're going to come back a lot. You're not going to be there one time. You're going to have to continue to come back, and it's a matter of eliminating the logical explanations, the things that you find about EMF or giraffes. You know, maybe they need to caulk. You know, it's as simple as that. We've thrown up some stuff like that by having the homeowner caulk the outside of their house. You know, we found squirrels in the attic. You know, animals can be a part of this. It's really looking at the reality behind what's happening and not falling in love with what could be or what might be. It's really helping the client in the way you should. And that's by taking their experience and looking at each event individually and trying to find an answer that can help them sleep at night or help them deal with it when you're not there. And it could take several visits. It could take 10, 20 visits to really help them through that. And as long as they follow your advice, you know, they can get to that point eventually.
Yeah, and I think that's a very good point that you make, Brian, because you can't be wham, bam, thank you, ma'am, and we're out of here. You really have to gauge where your client's at. You have to see what's going on with them and try to feed into what their belief system is. And, you know, just to give you an example, how many times, and I know this will probably resonate with you, Brian, how many times have you gone out on investigations and a person starts talking to you during the course of the interview and they start explaining to you sleep paralysis?
Right.
And they're totally unfamiliar with the characteristics of sleep paralysis, which is a legitimate, if you've undergone or gone through it, it's a very realistic feeling that's hard to, you know, say didn't occur. But many people don't understand what it is.
Right.
They actually think it's a manifestation.
Right, exactly. Yeah, they you know, it's the old hag syndrome, I think they used to call that,
mm-hmm.
before they really understood what was happening, and people misconstrue that. They don't understand, and it also follows suit with things like epilepsy. If they've had epilepsy in their family, it's a good possibility that they have that, and one of the things about having epilepsy is you will see full apparitions. They actually state that, and I've read some paperwork about that. To me, that's amazing, you know, to have an epileptic seizure. You can actually see people who are not there or situations that do not exist. And some people don't even realize they have epilepsy. So but it's also knowing what the symptoms and signs are of epilepsy before you would say that to a client. Obviously, you don't want to diagnose anyone. You want to be careful what you say, you know, about getting counseling or trying to counsel anyone through, because in the state of Ohio, you have to be licensed to do so. And I wouldn't give anyone any information about medical. I would, you know, maybe suggest that it could be a possibility if they're showing all the symptoms of epilepsy, but never diagnose.
Nope. Doug, you still there?
I think I put him to sleep.
No, sorry about that. I was actually talking. You just couldn't hear me. I muted my mic for a second. What I was saying was that, you know, it's a good point that you have to be careful about not diagnosing. Even when you're coaching be aware of that, because in most states, you really need to be a licensed psychologist to do that. And you can just be aware of it. You don't want to go too far. You want to be careful and tactful with how you encourage them to seek medical help. And, you know, you could always verbalize it with saying some of the things that other people have done to rule things out are, and, you know, get a checkup, maybe talk with a counselor. Some people have done that and found good results. Other people haven't, so it's up to you. Things like that. Just good point, Brian.
It's part of the process. You have to go through as many steps as you can to help the client. It's one of the many things you have to really address if you feel that it's pertinent to their particular case.
So from your experience and what you know now, for somebody getting into the field, what would you recommend? You know, what would be your top several points to help them, steer them in the right direction, to help them be better equipped for investigations?
Well, for somebody new to the field or wanting to get into the field, the number one suggestion I have, and this is gold, the number one thing I have is buy my book. I wrote a book last year. It was I wanted to lay the groundwork for somebody, just exactly like you said, somebody who's new mm-hmm. to the field that wants to get involved, or maybe they've seen it on TV and they're not so sure about what's really involved. And I didn't want to write it in the aspect, I'm sure you guys have read some books that are the person trying to impress everyone or throw sure. as many theories out as humanly possible. I don't want to confuse people. I wanted to keep it ground level, but not offend anybody who's already in the field, not make it seem like it was elementary.
Right.
And I wrote a book called Handbook for the Amateur Paranormal Investigator or Ghost Hunter. It's How to Become a Successful Paranormal Group. And it covered a lot of topics, obviously, about being successful, which includes a lot of topics that you've covered in your CPI program, your Certified Paranormal Investigator program, about communication is key, mm-hmm. whether it's within your group or other groups. And I think that's another topic I really wanted to address, was working with other groups. You know, you get the random email about, hey, I want to exchange links, and that's it. That's all you ever hear from them. And I like to, you know, I always email back and say, thanks for the link. I appreciate the contact, but if you have any other questions, you have anything you want to ask, please ask. And I hope that you'll be there for me if I have a question for you that I want to ask you. And 9 times out of 10, you never hear back from them. And sometimes you do, and I've created a lot of good friendships and relationships that way with many groups. But it's something that you don't see enough of. You hear a lot of people talk about it. You see a lot of paranormal unity and groups wanting to get together, but you don't see a whole lot of it except for on social
exactly.
networks.
Exactly.
And it's really something that's lacking. And that's why I'm really excited about Paranexus, because you're not about bringing groups together, but you're about binding knowledge and about binding information together, which is huge. It's important to bind the knowledge, to share the knowledge with other people, and to educate. I mean, education is huge. I could tout that I'm an expert. I've been in this field for 13 years. You see people that say our collective group has had 40 years of experience. Well, we got 10 people that have 4 years of experience. How is that really 40 years?
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of confusing, but
well,
we always have to learn. We've talked about that already, but
yeah, definitely, and that's what Paranexus is about. And it is. It's not about bringing quote groups together. It's about bringing people together, and more specifically, serious researchers. And that's why the growth has been so slow, because among the field, there just aren't that many serious, passionate researchers, in my opinion.
Well, speaking for myself, like I had told you through email, I'd kept a watchful eye on this and was watching to see how things progressed and see what you guys stood for. And I've always been impressed, and I was thinking, well, this is too good to be true. And, you know, you invited me to take the course, and I took the course, and I fell in love with it. I think it's even someone like myself that's I've been a lot of places, I've learned a lot from a lot of different people, I've had a lot of experiences, I still learned a lot from it. And
good.
Not so much just the basics, but there's a lot of information in there that I think is really, really important that a lot of people take a look at. And you know, for everyone to kind of continue their education, it's important. No matter how much you think you know, there's always somebody out there that's going to know something that you don't. And I think it's important
well,
we all share that.
Yeah, and it complements. We complement each other, because our knowledge base can be different. And one person might know something another person doesn't.
Universe.